There we go. Hi, my name is Peggy Gallagher Green, and I am an extremely grateful member of Al-Anon. I need to do something to kind of help me relax a little bit up here. It is Sunday morning. My dad used to say that he would be as nervous as a whore in church, but I'll tell you what, I'm as nervous as an alcoholic in his first Al-Anon meeting. Thank you. That really helps calm me down. I want to thank the committee. You have been so gracious. Everybody at this convention, people in Florida are beautiful, and I just love you. You're so great. I don't know if you guys know this, but I'm a stand-in speaker. About 6 weeks ago, Karen called, and she said, I understand you're going to be in Orlando over Labor Day. And I said, yes, we are. And she said, well, would you fill in for our speaker who had to cancel on Sunday morning? And my sponsor has taught me to never say no to any type of an Al-Anon request. And so, of course, my answer was yes, and that's why I'm here. There are so many long-term Al-Anons in here. That is so wonderful. It is just great. And all of you that are here for your first convention, the first Al-Anon convention that I went to was a spiritual experience for me. I left after the Sunday morning meeting, and I could not stop crying. I wasn't in a really good place in my life, and the speaker that morning touched my heart. And it was just so spiritual. And I can tell you that already this morning has been very spiritual for me. I wish I had some Kleenex because I know I'm going to cry. But I guess I'm supposed to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. I grew up in Arizona in a very small town in the southwest corner of the state. It borders California and Mexico. My dad was born and raised there. He was a native, and those were very few. And he was a farmer, and he farmed, and he ran a couple of cotton gins, so he was a very busy man. My parents married when my mom was really young. She was 17, and on their first date, he got drunk, he proposed to her, and he bought a house. And I think it was about 6 months later they got married. I loved my dad. He was just such a vicarious man. And I'm not going to tell you that he was an alcoholic, because I don't know if he was, but I know he drank an awful lot. And what happened was my mother reacted to his drinking. My dad would go out, and he'd be doing business, and he'd come home very late, and he would be drunk, and my mom would be waiting for him when he walked through the door, yelling and screaming, and she would be throwing things, and the fight was on. I don't remember my dad ever raising his voice to my mother. I'm sure that he did, but I don't remember that. All I remember was my mother's reaction to my dad's drinking. The other thing, my dad used to take my sister and I into the bars when we were little. We lived in a very, very small community. It was a farming community, probably just a couple of hundred people. And in those days, you could take your kids into the bar. You know, nobody said anything. And we had a great time. We had lots of fun. And we would entertain ourselves while my dad drank. And today I can walk by one of those types of bars, and you can smell it as you walk by. And it just brings back all these memories from my childhood. And they were good memories, really good memories. I had a great childhood. I thought that there was absolutely nothing wrong. We went on vacations. We did lots of fun things. My mom and dad never physically abused us, and we had a really great time. But because of the things that I have done as an adult around my son, I know what I learned. And that was that when my mother was upset with my dad because he wasn't doing what she thought he should be doing, my sister and I disappeared. We were no longer there because I did that to my son. Of course, we were there physically, but she didn't see us. And she would take her anger at my dad out on us. And I was so uncomfortable. I felt like I did not belong, and I learned how to isolate very early. I would go into places where it was dark and quiet, and I would just, you know, go into my own mind, and everything would be okay. I lived in a lot of fantasy when I was a kid. And still to this day, when I'm really upset about something, I just want it to be dark. I just want it to be quiet, because that's peaceful to me. My dad had his first heart attack when I was 16 years old, and that changed his life dramatically. He had to stop drinking. He became very angry, and I had to become a caretaker. My mom by this time had decided to go to work, and I'm the oldest. There's only two of us. I have a younger sister, and I had to help take care of her. She's not that much younger than I am. She's only 18 months younger, so I don't know why I had to take care of her. She was 14. I'm sure she could have taken care of herself. But they couldn't do things, and so it was up to me to do those things. And so I started, you know, being the caretaker around the house. I also did not like what was going on at home. My sister has always been very jealous of me. I don't know why. I love her very much, and we have never had a good relationship. And she was very mean to me. She was sometimes physical, and I really wanted out of the house, and I was able to do that. I got pregnant, and I got married. I was 17 years old, and about a month after I got married, I lost the baby. And the man that I married was only 19, so he was probably just a boy. And we moved over to Indio, California, and I don't know if any of you know where that is, but it's kind of an armpit of the nation. It is not a real, it's a real hot spot, but not a hot spot, if you know what I mean. We had been married about 6 weeks, and of course I'm 17 years old, and you know, like Michael was sharing, Donna Reed and Father Knows Best, and that's what I'm trying to do, and I'm getting up in the morning, and I'm fixing his breakfast, and I'm packing his lunch to send him off to work, and he beat me. I had never been physically beaten in my life, and that, he just beat me for no reason. I don't know where it came from. And that's the way our relationship was. And what I learned in our relationship was to try to fix it, to try to control it. And the way I did that was to look a certain way when he got home. If I only looked this way, if I only fixed this meal, if the house only looked this way, then he wouldn't hit me tonight when he comes home. I don't know if he was an alcoholic. That was a long time ago. I know that he drank. We were both young, so if we did drink, and I will tell you right now, I am not an Al-Anon that sat back on the sidelines and did not party right along with him, because I did. And I know we had beer every once in a while. We had some wine every once in a while. That's all I remember. I don't remember him being drunk when he hit me. We moved to Texas for a while. He joined the Army, and we went to Texas, and we lived there, and he continued to beat me. And physical things, I started reacting physically, like breaking out in hives, and real bad hives where I'd have to go to the hospital. And we came home on leave at Christmas time, and that was all that I could take. I didn't want to live like that anymore. And I had only lived like that for about 18 months, but I knew that that was not the right way. My parents, I was perfectly calm the night I said goodbye, go, leave. I was perfectly calm. I knew in my mind exactly what I wanted. Now my parents, on the other hand, my dad standing outside with a shotgun, my mother standing in the door in her underwear, and, you know, I'm like, you guys just need to calm down. This is okay. But I don't know, I was talking this morning at breakfast with Jana. You know, I don't know where that man is today. I haven't seen him since the day I said goodbye. And that's really a sad thing. It's not that I need to know where he is, but just I'd like to know. I'd like to know how he is. And what set off after that was my looking for him in all the wrong places. In Arizona at that time, the legal drinking age was 19, and I was in the bars, and I was looking for him, because I didn't know that I had this tremendous hole inside of me, and I just needed someone to fix it and make it feel okay. And there were just so many. I look back at the way I lived my life before I got into Al-Anon, and it was just a really painful thing to look back at it, because I didn't know how desperate and how lonely I was until I got here. I got married again when I was 20. That man is an alcoholic. The only thing that he wanted to do was come home after working, sit down, drink a six-pack of beer, and then go to bed, and that was it. We'd go out on the weekends sometimes for recreation, and I drank right alongside him. But, you know, there was one day, like Larson said, that, you know, it just stopped being fun anymore. And it always got to the point where, okay, we have to grow up. We have to, you know, stop doing this. I'm going to stop it. Now you need to stop it. And that never works. Never happens. The other really sick thing I do is I look for the beer sales in the newspaper, you know. And yet I don't want him to drink, but I'm looking for the beer sales in the newspaper. It just amazes me, the crazy things that we do. I wanted a child so badly, and that child was going to fix the way that I felt, you know, because babies love us unconditionally. And I just knew that if I had a child, that we would be okay, our marriage would be okay, and that I would be okay. And he really didn't want any kids, and I really had a hard time getting pregnant. And what my mother said to me was, "Baby, God is punishing you because you got pregnant when you were only 17 years old." And I carried that with me for a very long time. That really hurt me. So I had a punishing God now, because I believed that that was true. I finally got pregnant, and I just loved this little boy. And our marriage had just, you know, I just didn't want to be there anymore. That's the way it gets for me at the end of a relationship. I just don't want to be there anymore. I can put up with it for about 6 years, and then I just don't want to be there anymore. And I walked out the door, and I have never gone back. And, you know, that's just the way I do it. When it's over, it's over. And I continued again looking for another him in all the wrong places. And I got a really great opportunity to move to Fresno. And so I packed up my son. He was 3 years old, and off we went. And I didn't think one thing about it. I didn't know anybody there. I didn't have any family there, no friends. All I had was a job. And everybody kept telling me, "Oh, my God, how can you do that? That's just, you know, so courageous of you just to pick up and move." I didn't think a thing of it. I just, you know, that's just what you do. You just go. And of course, I thought it was going to be different. I thought that I'd be able to change my life, do something different. And naturally, I didn't. You know, it started all over again. And I couldn't understand why I kept picking the same kind of guys. I did get involved with one man that was probably the worst relationship that I was in. He was dealing drugs out of my house. I was totally obsessed with him, totally. And I ended up in therapy at the end of that relationship, and the therapist told me that I was a woman who loved too much. And there was a book that had just come out at that time, and that was the title of the book. And she said, "You need to get that book. You need to read it." She also told me, "I think you are probably an adult child of an alcoholic." And I'm like, "No, that's impossible. That's totally impossible." She suggested a book by the same title. And so I got them both. I read them both. The first book, Women Who Love Too Much, I identified with every woman in that book. That's my problem. I just love way too much. So I stayed in a therapy group for quite a while. Now, this therapist never, ever mentioned Al-Anon, not once. She did mention ACA. I went to one meeting. I did not identify. I didn't like it, so I didn't go back. I stayed in a therapy group that she did for a couple of years. I did get a little bit better, but still the focus, I think, was more on the men that we had, the women that I was in this group with, was more on the men we had in our lives that we had just gotten out of relationships with, instead of on ourselves. So I grew a little bit, but not a lot. And what happened to me, though, in that therapy, is I realized what men were like for me. And I don't know where it came from, what I do today, but it was like the alcoholic. I envisioned a man being a bottle. And I knew that alcoholics could not put a bottle down, and that man was the same as that bottle. But I still didn't know anything about Al-Anon, and I realized that that's what was, you know, that that's what men were for me. They were an obsession. My third husband is the man I was married to when I came into Al-Anon. And let me tell you about the day that I met him. I was over at my friend's house, and he was her next-door neighbor. And it was kind of late in the evening, and he came over because he needed somebody's telephone number. He walked up to the door, came in, and he was about 6'2", very good-looking, very dark-complected, and I could see that he had a tremendous amount of potential. And that if he would just let me take care of him, he could meet all of that potential. And he really does. He's a very bright man, but he's also a very injured man. I was telling at breakfast this morning that he was very abused as a child, very emotionally, and he is an alcoholic. You know, alcoholism, as we all know, is a progressive disease, and what happened in that relationship is that this disease progressed in me to a point where I did not like myself anymore. I worked during the day, he worked at night. I was never content with things to be just okay. I had to always create some kind of commotion in our relationship. If it was all right, it wasn't comfortable. I started becoming a rager. I started throwing things. I never threw anything that broke like my mother did because I had been single for a long time. I knew how much they cost, and I didn't want to replace them. So I threw things like pillows. One time I went into a total rage attack, and I threw all of his books and broke the spines, and the pages were all over the house. I had such delight in that. But the crazy things, you know, like he'd go off fishing. That's the only thing he did. He worked and he fished. And he'd go out fishing, and that's where he could isolate, and that's where he could be most comfortable, and he'd drink, and he'd get loaded, and I'd be standing there at that window waiting for him to come home, waiting for that truck to come around the corner. Like, me standing there is going to magically make it appear. That is such insanity. And then when he'd get too drunk and he'd want to take off, I'd throw myself and say, "No, you can't leave. You know, you have to stay, you're too drunk," and he'd push me out of the way, and the fight would be on. And here's my little boy standing there watching all of this. And of course, he wants to protect his mother. And so he starts to get right in the middle of it. I did so many things before I came into Al-Anon that I have a tremendous amount of shame about with my son, leaving him with people that I did not even know. I've listened to many alcoholic women share from the podium the things that they did with their kids, and I feel that. I understand that. I identify with it. Because a man was always more important than my son. And I pushed him out of the way, and he disappeared just like I did when I was a little girl. And, you know, today I try to be the best mom that I can be. My son decided that he wanted to go live with his dad. He was 11 and a half years old, and he wanted to go back to Arizona, and he wanted to live with his dad. It was always more important what he thought or what you thought than how I felt. If you thought good thoughts, if I didn't, you know, ruffle your feathers, if you were okay, then I would be okay, no matter how I really felt inside. And so I let my son go live with his dad, knowing that that was not the best decision. And when I look back on it, I would have wanted to leave too. I was not a good person to live with. He and my husband had nicknamed me the General, and that was not a name that I liked at all. He left, and after he left, I'd call him on the telephone, and he would be totally different, totally different. I didn't know this child anymore. And it was time for him to come for his Christmas visit, and I sought the help of a therapist one more time. And, you know, therapists never stop at just once you go there to talk to them about. They got to dig a little bit deeper, you know, find out what's really going on. She really helped me to understand where my son was and what was going on with him, but she also wanted to know about me. She told me, "I think you're in an alcoholic relationship." And I had to agree with her. And she said, "I think you were also raised in an alcoholic home." And I had to agree with her. And she said, "I want you to enjoy your 2 weeks with your son, and I want you to come back and see me when he's after he leaves, and I want to know what it was like." I have to tell you, it was two of the worst weeks of my life. It's the 2 weeks that got me here. It's the 2 weeks that got me to you. I realized that I was married to a man who was just as mature as my 12-year-old son. I wanted to die in the worst way. I had a little sports car, and there was a street I drove down where the speed limit was 50 miles an hour, and I'd always go a little bit faster, and those telephone poles were so inviting. But it was that 12-year-old boy that kept me from driving my car into one of those poles, because you see, I got to the point where it was either homicide or suicide. There were many times when my husband and I would go out into the hills east of Fresno to go practice shooting, and I would think of ways that I could kill him and get back to town without anybody ever knowing it. I went to see that therapist one more time, and she told me about you. She said, "You don't need to come to me anymore. You need to go to Al-Anon. You need to get a sponsor, and you need to work the 12 steps." And that's exactly what I did. I went to my first Al-Anon meeting. I'll never forget it. It was a Thursday night, and it was a birthday meeting, and two people were celebrating a year in the program. And what I heard was hope. The hope I had not heard in so long. The topic of the meeting, I mean, I remember this so well. The topic was fear and faith. I had so much fear, and I had absolutely no faith. And I left that meeting, and I knew I was exactly where I needed to be. That was 7.5 years ago. I have not stopped coming. My life has changed so tremendously. What I clung to for a very long time, because you see, that was my third marriage, and I did not want to be a failure. I did not want to admit defeat one more time. And what I clung to for so long was that I could find happiness whether the alcoholic was drinking or not. And I knew that if those words were there, that it was for a reason, and that I could learn that. And I tried. I really did. But my marriage was over before I even walked down the aisle, because like I said, it was more important that what you thought than how I felt, and I did not want to marry that man when it came right down to it, and I walked down that aisle with him anyway, because we already had all these gifts, and his parents had spent lots of money, and I didn't want to say no. And after a year and a half in the program, he was trying to get sober. I just couldn't do it anymore, and I told him that, you know, our marriage, it was over with. And the divorce was very hard. It wasn't hard because I didn't want it to happen. It was hard because I had to make some financial amends. And what I had to do is I had to pay him spousal support. And that just about ate me up. My sponsor and another friend went with me to court when the judge ordered it. And I was so angry. I was so angry because I had to do this. I had a job, he had a job, he had a college education and never used it. You know, I was so mad. And here I had our house, I had all the bills, and I had so much financial fear, I did not know what I was going to do. And my sponsor said, "You know what to do, it's in the steps." So I inventoried my marriage. I did a fifth step with my sponsor. I looked at my character defects in that marriage. And then I asked him if I could make amends to him. And I did. I made those amends. I am so controlling. I wrote them out, and I gave them to him. Because I have a tendency to forget what I say. I can walk away from here and forget what I have said. And I did not want him to come back to me and say, "You did not say that." So I wrote them out and I gave them to him. I I'm here to tell you, if you're going through a divorce, do not do that, because it will come back and haunt you. We had to go back to court, and I will tell you that when I did make that ninth step, that fear of financial, those financial fears disappeared. They were gone. I was completely relieved of them. But what did happen, because I needed to be controlling, is when we went back to court a second time, he had given those amends to his attorney, who had been given them, who had gave them to my attorney, and she presented them to me at court. And I sat there, and I cried, and I thought, this is all for nothing. This program is all for nothing. God has given me up one more time. And it went through my mind that fast. It did not stay there, because I knew that this program worked, and I immediately knew what I had done. I had tried to control it one more time. And that's, you know, that's just it. That's what happens. And I was okay. I was totally okay with it. And I didn't make those financial amends for much longer. And, of course, by then I had gotten remarried, and my current husband, he did not like me making those spousal support payments. That was his money. He didn't like that. But so many things have happened in the last 7 years. That summer, right before I divorced, I have to say, in the last 5 years, my journey in my recovery has just taken me into places that I would have never, ever thought I would go. 5 years ago, when that third husband was trying to get sober, and my son had come back for his summer vacation, he was 14 years old, he got out of the car, and he was awful. I won't even say the words that I would really like to say as to how bad he was. And I talked to my sponsor. I had no serenity. He wasn't going to do anything that I told him to do. He made that perfectly clear. I took him one day to get a haircut. He was so angry about it. And my nephew was with us. And we were going to go to downtown Clovis, which is right by where we live, and they have a farmer's market. And he was so ugly and so mean to me, and I said, we're not going anywhere. Well, what do you do with a 14-year-old? You know, you can't spank them. You can't send them to their room. So what I did is I planted his butt in a chair in the kitchen. And I said, you're going to stay there until you can apologize to me, because that was totally unacceptable what you said. And my nephew and I, he's yelling at me. He's doing all kinds of things in that kitchen, and my nephew and I are just sitting in the living room having a wonderful conversation, watching television, just going on about our business, and that kid is just ranting, raving in that chair in the kitchen. And he kept telling me how to go to the bathroom. I said, well, it's too bad. You can sit there. You can wet your pants. I do not care. Well, he didn't wet his pants, but he did pee on the floor. He is such an honor kid. But he had to clean it up, too. But that's how awful he was that summer. I couldn't live with it. I talked to my sponsor. I talked to my friends in the program, and they said, you know, serenity is the most important thing to you. He is to a point in his life where there's nothing more that you can do. He is God's kid, and you have to give him up to God. And if you want serenity in your house, then maybe he needs to go back to his dad and spend the summer with his dad. And that's what I did. And it was one of the hardest things I had to do. I cried for a week. I put him on the plane and I cried. I went to many, many meetings. I went to open AA meetings, and I just sat there and I cried. And about 3 weeks after he got home, he called me and he said, Mom, I need to talk to you about my dad. And because I was willing to do what you suggested, to take the suggestions of my sponsor and what this program has given me, I have a relationship with him today that I would have never had I not done that. He's 19 years old, and he's doing things that I don't like. I don't like them at all. But it's his life, it's his path, and he has to walk it. And the only thing that I can do for that kid is just love him. When I wanted to make amends to him, I didn't really know how I was going to do it. My sponsor said, you just tell him. You just tell him that you did a lot of wrong things and that you're going to try to be the best mom you can be. And I said, okay, that's what I'll do. And I said, and I'll do a living ninth step with him. She said, we don't do that. It doesn't say anywhere in the book that we do a living ninth step. I said, well, that's all I know to do is just to be a good mom. She said, well, let me just be a good mom. What I later read in a forum or one of our books was that it's not a living ninth step that we do. We do a 12th step. I carry this message to my son. I practice these principles in all my affairs. And, you know, I don't know where his path is going to take him. He didn't have a God for a long time. He still doesn't have one, but he's on a spiritual path. He's trying to find some kind of a higher power in his life. We talk about it. And I'm so grateful that I can sit and listen and let him find his own higher power. That he doesn't have to have the one that I have. He can find his own. I had to set some boundaries with him recently and told him that if he did what I had seen him do, that he would have to move out of our house. And that was a very scary thing for me because I don't want to abandon my son. I felt I abandoned him a long time ago, but I also know that he can't do the unacceptable in my home. And he was okay with it. You know, what I anticipated would happen, my fears did not happen. He said, okay, Mom, I understand. And that was it. No argument, no nothing. I want to tell you about my husband. It's so hard for me sometimes to talk about my husband. I love him so much. I met my husband when I was still married to my third husband. We were just friends. It was never anything inappropriate. We only talked about recovery and that was it. And my husband is here right now. And my husband doesn't look like most people look like. And God gave me a relationship with him that I could learn to love him from the inside out. And he is one of the most beautiful people that I know. And I tell him all the time how handsome he is, because to me he is truly, truly handsome. And I love his spirituality, and I love his insides. We don't have a perfect marriage, thank goodness, because I need to continue to grow. And, you know, he gives me reasons to grow. And I give him reasons to grow. This week hasn't been the best week in the world for us. We've had some difficulties, and it has been very hard. And I have just been acting as if I have been live and let live. I've been wanting to get in there and fix it and make it all okay. I'd have to call my sponsor almost every day because I wanted to do something to get out of this place because I don't like it when it's uncomfortable. And I just wanted it to be better and I wanted it to be over with. And the other night I was sitting in that dark place that's so comfortable for me and I'm going, God, what can I do to fix it? What can I do to fix it? And I knew that all I had to do was just let God fix it. You know, I always want to fix it and make it better because I don't like it when it's uncomfortable. I want it to be okay. It's been a week of growth, believe me, it has. And it's okay. It's okay now. You know, my sponsor said, this too shall pass. I'm like, when? When will it pass? I want it over now. You know, and it has passed. It's going to come again. It always will. But every time I do something different, every time I take the principles of this program, I do what's suggested of me, my life changes. I become a better person. And I can't do that alone. I cannot, because let me tell you, if I sit and think for very long, I have got it all figured out and it never works. You know, so I have to rely on you. I have to rely on this program and I really have to rely on my God. When I came here, like I said, I had absolutely no faith whatsoever. I have a faith today that is just unbelievable to me, totally unbelievable. I have a God of my understanding, and my God loves me. No matter how ugly I am, no matter how wonderful I am, He loves me every single day. My husband and I started a business not too long ago, which could be a very prosperous business for us. And I went into that financial fear again, but this time it was not financial fear of failing, it was financial fear of being prosperous. And we had gone on a retreat, and Father Bernie lives here in Florida. He lives in Ocala. If you ever hear of a retreat that Father Bernie is doing, go to it. It will be one of the most spiritual experiences you will ever have. And we went on the retreat. We go every year and flies back out to Fresno, and they have this spiritual retreat. And he will take time to spend with the different people that are there. You just put your name down, and he'll spend time with you. So I went in, and I wanted to talk to him about my fear. And he goes, "I don't understand. Why are you so afraid?" He says, "This is wonderful. You know, you could be all right. If anything happened to Matt, you would be okay." And I'm like, "I know, but it's like I don't deserve it. Deserve it." And he said, "Let me ask you something. If you had a little girl and you could buy her anything that you wanted to, if you had the money to buy her, take her anywhere that you wanted to, would you?" And I don't have a daughter, but I have a granddaughter. And I said, that's who I thought of. And I said, "Well, of course I would." And he said to me, "Aren't you God's kid? Aren't you deserving of everything that your father has to give to you?" And I said, "Yes, I am." You know, when I came here, I didn't think I was worth anything. I really didn't. Today I know that I am a very worthwhile person. You have given me the strength to quit a job after 13 years, to go into business for myself, to know that I am worthy of somebody calling me and saying, "Can you come and help us at our business?" Because I'm a consultant. I didn't have that when I came in here. I could not have done that, and you have given all of that to me. I am so eternally grateful for everything. And this weekend has been so wonderful. It has been so spiritual. I get to go to a lot of AA conventions with my husband. He gets an opportunity to speak quite a bit at different places in the country, and so I'm usually around a lot of alcoholics, and believe me, I love it. But I really, really like being with us. I like just being with us. And I do want to say that I am so glad to see that there are a lot of alcoholics here with their Al-Anons. We don't do that in Northern California. Something happened before I ever got into the program, and there was a big split, and we don't participate together in Northern California. And it's very, very sad, because this is a family disease, and we all need to get well together. And the very last thing that I'm going to close with is about sponsorship. I love my sponsor. She's wonderful. And I love the people that I sponsor. My first sponsor in this program was a very loving woman. She reminded me of my grandmother. She was the same age as my mother, but she reminded me of my grandma. And she gave me a lot of unconditional love, which I really needed in this program when I first got here. But the sponsor that I have today is one that kicks my butt when I need it. And what I have learned is from listening to the ladies in AA and them talking about how they pull each other's covers and they don't let them get away with anything. And I think that sometimes in this program we are too easy with each other, and that we need to take responsibility. We need to work the steps of this program. We cannot get it by sitting in a meeting. You know, you can go home and you can sit in your garage and you are never going to be a car. And if you do not work those 12 steps that were so graciously given to us by Alcoholics Anonymous, you are never going to have true recovery in your life. You know, I am not recovered. I hope that I never get there because I want to stay recovering one day at a time for the rest of my life. And I'm not going to tell you to keep coming back. What I'm going to tell you is just stay here. You don't have to come back. Just stay. Thank you.